Please be seated, everyone. We have Justice Perry in Las Vegas. He's participating by video conference. And we also have Justice Seda, who is participating by listening to this contemporaneously while it's being webcast. She could not be here physically, but she is listening to the argument, so all seven of us are participating in this matter. The case on calendar is Lexus Project, Inc. versus City of Henderson and Henderson Animal Care and Control, case number 60977. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Chief Justice.
Please do so. You wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I do. We'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
May it please the Court, I'm Richard Rosenthal, the General Counsel and co-founder of the Lexus Project. My co-counsel are Kathy McCarthy and Robert Eisenberg. All three of us are pro bono on this matter. At the very moment that the one-year-old grandson of Elizabeth Keller lay dying before her on the lawn as paramedics worked feverishly to revive him, an officer of the Henderson Animal Control was thrusting a paper and waving it in her face, saying, "You must sign this, I'm taking your dog." Elizabeth Keller adopted this dog when it was 4 weeks old. They hand-fed it, and it was adopted to help her through the depression she was going through, suffering the effects of chemotherapy for lung cancer. It was love at first sight, and both Elizabeth Keller and her family acknowledged that it was the love from this dog and her devotion to him that helped her get through that bleak period. The unfortunate accident that gave rise to this tragedy occurred only minutes before the incident on the lawn, when the child, a one-year-old toddler, who insisted on walking and spent more time on the floor than on his feet, fell on the dog's sleeping dog's head and lifted himself up by the dog's ears. The dog, suddenly awoken by surprise and presumably unsure of what was causing the pain, reached out and grabbed the child in its mouth. Within seconds, the father turned on the lights and said the dog's name, and the dog immediately released the child. Prior to this night, the dog, who regularly played with and snuggled and cuddled and slept with this child, had never growled or displayed any aggressive behavior, either towards people or any other animal. The court has raised three questions that it wanted us to specifically address, the first of which, whether Elizabeth Keller was a necessary party. I will acknowledge that the better practice would have been to name Elizabeth Keller in the original filing. However, we do not believe the failure to do so was fatal to the process. And considering the grief that she was going through over a tragedy that occurred so soon before, our belief was that compassion and humanity dictated not to at that time. As the suit did not seek to challenge either her rights or her conduct, and our basis for standing was the Companion Trust statute, we did not believe naming her to be a necessity, especially in light of...
Also, you're getting into standing. At the time of the filing by the project, by the trust, how does the trust have any connection whatsoever with the dog. This is prior to any purported transference to the trust or anything else, but what gives this trust the right to come in to court on behalf of anyone?
It is our belief, Your Honor, that NRS 163.0075 and the New York statute, EPTL 7-8.1, which create the right for the trust, along with it, create the standing. The trust, as I'm sure the court is aware, prior to these statutes, could not be considered anything but honorary trusts because there was no named person who could enforce the trust and the rule against perpetuities. In setting up the trust statutes, the legislatures of both states provided a mechanism whereby the trust existed and the dog or animal was the actual beneficiary, as opposed to merely...
But where does it grant the trust any right to assert anything on behalf of?
That, Your Honor, if I may, was the second question, which I will get to immediately. There are two theories that we are operating under.
And I ask you that question because at the time, give or take, whether I agree or disagree is not really important. Whether the actual owner, the family, still owned the dog or whether it was transferred to the city of Henderson. But at that point, the ownership of the dog was in someone else's capacity.
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
So the question still, basically, and maybe by answering this question, whether a trust can litigate on behalf of a beneficiary, you can answer that. And the question of what right do they have over whoever owned the animal at that time to come into court.
There are two bases that we claim for standing. First of all, both the Nevada Companion Animal Trust Statute and the New York statute provide that the trust terminates upon the death of the animal. Therefore, to the extent that the trustee has an obligation to maintain the trust and carry out the wishes of the trust settler as set forth in the trust.
Counsel, I guess, you know, you're still seeming missing. The fundamental question is, there is someone or something who technically owns this animal.
Yes, there is, Your Honor.
And so how do you, in essence, trump whatever their rights or privileges are as to control of this animal?
It is not our claim that we trump the rights. Our claim is that based upon the creation of the trust, the permissive creation of the trust under these two statutes.
Well, you didn't move under the Nevada statute, so you're going to have to make your argument under the New York statute there.
The New York statute, on this issue, we believe the New York statute and the Nevada statute are virtually identical. So under either statute, Your Honor, there is not a right, and we concede that in a claim as against the owner, Elizabeth Keller, we most likely would not have a basis to go against her wishes. We're not claiming there's a right to control the dog, but rather there's a right to seek the court's intervention to prevent an injustice.
But Mr. Rosen, didn't Ms. Keller sign over the rights to the dog to Lexis Project?
Yes, she did. And our position is that whether or not they were standing at the first instance, when Judge Kishner ruled there was no standing, whether correctly or incorrectly, based upon lack of ownership, Elizabeth Keller reached out to Lexis Project, said, "Save my dog," turned over ownership, and thus ratified the trust.
Counsel, is that, do we have any affidavit as to that, or is that just you testifying as you stand there today?
We have the affidavit as to turning over the trust. The actual wording was what she said to me.
But you have Mrs. Keller's affidavit, correct?
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
and it established...
Mr. Rosenthal, I'm a little confused. At what point did she sign over the ownership and control? Because I thought the night of the attack, she relinquished all ownership rights and titles to the dog. So how can she take that back when she's relinquished it?
Your Honor, the circumstances under which she allegedly relinquished it was such as to call into question. I would go on that issue to the U.S. Supreme Court statements in Ricketts v. Adamson, quoting Johnson v. Zerbst. A waiver is ordinarily an intentional relinquishment or abandonment of a known right or privilege. As she stood there on the lawn watching the paramedics attempting to revive her grandson, for the animal control officer to put a paper in her face and say, you've got to sign this, I'm taking your dog, without giving her a copy, paper that did not explain anything.
But was that aspect addressed by the district court judge?
No.
Or is this something that's just being presented this for the first time?
No, it wasn't. The first time it came up, Your Honor, was at the hearing when the people produced that document. And when she turned over the dog, she specifically denied having transferred it and explained that she'd never gotten a copy of the paper. There was people never suggested she got a written notice of her rights such that she couldn't waive them.
Counsel, we have an order that was issued by the judge, and at her finding number 15, Ms. Kelly voluntarily relinquished custody of the animal to the city of Henderson and advised that she did not intend to contest the viciousness declaration. That's in the judge's finding.
Your Honor, it is our contention, first of all, that without an evidentiary hearing or any fact-finding, the hearing, that finding was erroneous. Secondly, once the court found there was no standing, based upon lack of ownership, which was conceded from the beginning, that to go forward on any fact-finding was improper. Third, to the extent that NRS Rule 17, I believe it is, requiring this court's determination in, I believe it's the Tarkanian case, requires the court to either have adjourned to have us name Elizabeth Keller, if she's going to find what Elizabeth Keller did and determine Elizabeth Keller's rights, or add her on the court's own motion sua sponte.
Well, maybe it wasn't necessary, as you suggest, to add her if the trust contention in the district court ultimately is that the initial transfer to the city was improper because it was made under duress. You were, in effect, contesting ownership of Onion. You maintain you own Onion. Is that right?
Well, at the first instance, Your Honor, on May 11th, we did not know of this purported transfer. That was the first notice we had. On May 12th, Elizabeth Keller contacted us and transferred ownership to us. In our motion to reconsider, based upon that, yes, we did, but at that point, our contention that contesting ownership was as the successor in interest to Elizabeth Keller, and it is our position that the issue of standing based upon the trust statutes effectively mooted by Elizabeth Keller's actions.
In effect, on the motion for reconsideration, your argument is we own Onion, and we make a claim to the ownership of this dog.
Exactly, Your Honor.
And we'd like to challenge the voluntariness of the transfer of Onion to the city.
Right. Yes, and it should be noted, Your Honor, that the people in their brief and on the papers are hedging their bets. To the extent they say there's a transfer, they also say that Elizabeth Keller had the right to demand the hearing and the other rights. If there was a transfer of all right and title to the city, then she wouldn't have a continuing right. So the city is trying to take the position of she may have transferred, we may have taken custody.
Well, let's assume for the moment that the district court judge should have given you an opportunity to maintain your ownership in Onion. how do you address the timing requirements that exist for 10 days before the city is in a position to proceed with the action it intended to take as to Onion?
In two different ways. First of all, because the city did not give Elizabeth Keller a copy of the paper she signed, nor did they give her any notice of her right to a hearing, it is our contention that 10 days effectively did not actually start to run.
Do you have any cases that indicate that that they're required to provide her with an explanation, as you suggest, of her right to a hearing in 10 days?
I would suggest that A. Johnson v. Zerps, the U.S. Supreme Court case, says it must be a waiver must be known.
That's a separate question. You're arguing a moment ago that the notice is defective. A, because she didn't get a copy, although it looks to me like the same document that in which she transferred ownership contained the notice of her right to the 10-day hearing, and she signed it. So how is that defective notice?
No, Your Honor, there is none in the document, and I have here, there is nothing about a hearing.
Okay.
Secondly, she never got a copy of this document. It was thrust in her face, she signed it, and she went back to watching about her grandson. A copy was never given to her. The first time any copy was received was from the city on the 11th.
Does that answer your question, Justice?
Yes, Sotomayor? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, wait a minute. And not exactly.
Okay.
I would request, if possible, for at least a moment to rebut.
I will give you 3 minutes, and I'll add 3 minutes to opposing counsel's time. I believe Justice Hardesty has an additional question.
So your argument is that the transfer of ownership, the animal impound, fails to give notice of the existence of this right to a hearing and determination of viciousness?
That is correct, Your Honor. It is also our position that under Matthews v. Eldridge, the U.S. Supreme Court case, there, because the intention to put the dog down constitutes forfeiture, there is the right to a due process hearing that the animal control, the animal hearing that's provided by the statute does not meet.
Counsel, I'm troubled. Mr. You have not raised a constitutional issue as to the statute at an earlier date. And secondly, let me finish, please.
Sorry, Your Honor.
And additionally, finding 15, it states, as Ms. Keller voluntarily relinquished custody of the animal to the city of Henderson and advised that she did not intend to contest the viciousness declaration, and then defendants understood words and action, but finding 17, Ms. Keller also stated to Officer Zarak with Officer Starr as a witness that she did not intend to contest the viciousness declaration. That's in the court's findings of fact, which would lead a reasonable person to believe that she was aware. And I understand a written document was not provided to her, but it appears from the finding of fact that she was told.
Except that the finding of fact was not at the end of a fact finding. It was simply the judge walked in on the day of the argument on the motion with findings of fact that effectively adjudicate Elizabeth Keller's right without adding Elizabeth Keller in as a party, giving her notice, or giving her an opportunity to contest those findings.
Did she ever seek that opportunity? Did she ever come forward and say, hey, I want to contest this? And also, I'd like to know what basis you have for making these arguments on her behalf.
It is our contention that when she contacted us and turned over ownership to us with the affidavit, which says that she did not...
And when again was that, just for my clarification?
That was on May 12th, the day after Judge Kishner ruled that there was no standing because we did not own the animal, that she immediately contacted us and turned over ownership of the animal in order to remedy that.
Mr. Rosenthal, again, if I could ask Chief just one question, and maybe opposing counsel can clarify this. If I understand it correctly, your contention was the court made findings of fact and concludes that without any type of evidentiary hearing and just took, I guess, on paperwork an argument. Is that correct? So in answer to Justice Douglas's question, there was nothing even presented as far as live testimony to derive those findings of fact from. Is that correct?
That's correct. Not only that, it was taken almost verbatim from the people's submission without giving us an opportunity to submit additional documents. The court walked in to the hearing with a 13 or 15 page decision that she read onto the record. So it wasn't a situation where people submitted the papers, we got it the afternoon before, and the court gave us an opportunity, do you want to contest, do you want to present anything else as a fact finding? It was simply the court that day took the people's papers and decided these are the facts. And there was no opportunity or notice that we would get a chance to actually present evidence that this is not the case.
You've used up the additional 3 minutes, but I will give you an additional 2 for rebuttal.
Thank you.
The court has asked you a lot of questions, and I'll ask the clerk to add a full 5 minutes to Mr. Reed's time so everyone has the same amount of time.
Thank you very much.
Chief Justice Pickering, Justices, may it please the Court. My name is Brandon Kimball. I'm Assistant City Attorney for the City of Henderson. With me here today is my colleague, Michael Lowe, fellow Assistant City Attorney. We represent the City of Henderson. I want to get right to some of the arguments that counsel made, but first I'd like to take just a few seconds to update the Court because I think the Court might be concerned, and I want to set the record straight. I spoke with Dr. Randy Wynn, who is the veterinarian that is contracted by the city, who sees Onion 5 times a week. He has reported to me that Onion is doing very well in his environment, that he's fairly thriving. He's becoming more used to the people that he knows at the shelter, and he's not as aggressive towards them, but unfortunately he's still unpredictable, and he is very aggressive with strangers. But no matter what happens in this dispute, I want the court to know, and I think the public should know, that the city of Henderson is concerned with the humane treatment.
Is this a city, have somebody walk the dog, or is a dog in a cage 24-7?
The dog is in a cage 24-7, but it is an extremely large cage. He has room to move around. It is a double-wide caged-off area. He's just too vicious to let out in the exercise yard. People can't handle him. All right, a couple of very quick points that need correcting. Justice Gibbons, you asked whether there was an opportunity for the Lexis Project to present facts in support of their arguments. Absolutely. There was a full hearing on the issues of the TRO and the preliminary injunction. The court didn't come in and just take facts from the people's argument, from the city's argument. We had attached affidavits and admissible evidence to our moving papers. They had none of that attached to...
But did the judge call any witnesses at this hearing?
You could look in the transcript. The judge asked them if they were going to put on any witnesses. They said they had none. In fact, at that point, they hadn't even spoken to Ms. Keller to see whether she wanted to give any testimony at the hearing. They hadn't spoken to anybody.
There was no hearing after Ms. Keller ostensibly transferred ownership to the Lexis Project, correct? There was no evidentiary hearing. My understanding of the record is they put in her affidavit saying, I have transferred ownership to the Lexis Project, and that's where they tried to make their case and were not able to do so.
After the hearing had taken place on May 11th, on May 12th. They go out and they get an affidavit from Ms. Keller. They get this purported transfer of the dog. There is no hearing at that time. There's no request for a hearing after that. All they filed was a motion for reconsideration. I don't know what opportunity there would have been to hold a hearing.
But weren't the written findings entered after the motion for reconsideration?
Sure, which I think raises some questions about the propriety of the motion for reconsideration, whether you can even file a motion for reconsideration when an order hasn't been entered for the judge.
But they were trying to bring new evidence to the judge's attention, which is the affidavit of Mrs. Keller. So to my mind, that really cuts against your position. Because there's an issue of fact then between her affidavit saying I was under duress when I signed this and I had no notice of the viciousness determination in the 10 days and so on, against the city's affidavits that say she was amply informed and did this voluntarily. And then you have a judicial finding based on two competing affidavits with no evidentiary hearing. That's a bit of a problem, isn't it?
I think the judge can look at those affidavits, and the judge in this order addressed all of the evidence that was on the record in her second order, the May 31st order, what the effect of that affidavit was. And if you want to, at that point, take a look at the matter on the merits, the court was entirely correct to determine that Ms. Keller, or really it isn't in the context of Ms. Keller, that they didn't have ownership of the dog.
When they brought the suit.
When they brought the suit, or even afterwards.
Because title had been, or ownership had been transferred validly.
Right, and we're not just making that up. That's in their pleadings. That's paragraph 17 of their complaint. That's where they acknowledge that Ms. Keller had relinquished the animal to the city and was aware that the animal was going to be euthanized.
But that was pleaded before she contacted them, correct?
Yes, it was, but it's still their pleading, and that's what the judge was certainly considering at the time.
Can I ask you one other question just on procedural background? I apologize because none of us were there. When the motion for the injunction, restraining order injunction, was that on a special setting or was it on a, like what we call a 9 o'clock law and motion calendar? But it was a whole stack of cases. Do you recall that?
The procedure was it was an order shortening time. I don't know if there were other matters on that day. I actually didn't argue at that hearing, but there's a lengthy transcript from that hearing. It's in both parties' appendix. It's nearly 100 pages.
Can you address for me, assuming we can get past the standing issue, counsel's Mr. Rosenthal's arguing about waiver and the administrative process and failure to exhaust the administrative remedies?
Well, yes, and that is actually one of the things that I wanted to address directly. If you allow this kind of argument for parties to avoid administrative proceedings, you're effectively going to nullify the purpose of administrative proceedings, which is to keep matters like this from coming to court before parties have exhausted their administrative remedies. And again, I think it's important to note from the record, this was no surprise to them. Their ability to file an appeal with the Animal Advisory Committee, I would direct the court's attention to volume 2 of the appellate's appendix at page 248. The court asks, if you make any request for an Animal Advisory Committee hearing in accordance with the ordinance, answer by Lexis Projects Counsel, no, we did not. No, I apologize. Probably procedurally, I should have.
But well, under the ordinance, counsel, who can make such a request? Isn't it just the owner?
The owner can make a request, but that doesn't relieve a party from first.
Well, no. Let's focus on the language of the ordinance. By the terms of the ordinance, who can make that request? Isn't it just the owner?
It is the owner. The owner can.
So someone, rightfully or wrongfully, who's making a claim in district court that they have some right to intercept this process, they wouldn't have had a right to file such a claim, would they?
That may be the case, but I don't think that relieves them from their responsibility to attempt to file that case under the administrative proceedings. Then they can come to the district court.
So do you have a case that says that an owner who can file such a claim, or even in a tax case where the property owner can file a challenge to a tax assessment, someone who's not that individual specified in that statute is subjected to the administrative procedures outlined in the statute?
A case doesn't come to mind. Mm-hmm. But if you allow that argument, if you allow parties to come into court where administrative procedures are conceivably available, then you're going to undermine the purpose for those administrative proceedings. Why wouldn't an animal interest group like this always intercede in district court on behalf of an owner where they felt it was necessary? It would totally nullify the requirement that the owner seek that administrative proceeding. And I think it's important, too, because they are attempting to stand in Ms. Keller's shoes here. They're asserting all the rights of an owner, even though they, throughout these proceedings, or throughout most of the proceedings, denied that they were the owner.
But you seem, as Mr. Rosenthal argued earlier, to seek the benefit of both arguments. The city's contention in this case, I understand, is that they're the owner. So neither Ms. Keller nor the project has the right to file a claim under the statute, do they?
That may well be the case. That may well be the determination. But I think Ms. Keller...
How can we resolve this case on the failure to exhaust administrative procedures if the city is standing on its ownership claim that was procured through this piece of paper handed to Mrs. Keller?
It could happen. She could have gone to the administrative... she could have gone to the Animal Advisory Committee and made all of those arguments in an administrative proceeding. She could have exercised those arguments there. She could have said, City, I don't believe that you are the owner. I believe I'm the owner. Then she would have had a decision from the Animal Advisory Committee that she could have appealed to district court.
So one of the things under the ordinance that can be challenged is the ownership's transfer itself. Is that your claim?
No, I think you have to. I think you're going to apply this. You're going to apply the statute at some point. Either the administrative committee, the advisory committee, is going to apply the statute, or on an appeal, the district court is going to apply the statute, and somebody may be able to raise an argument.
I thought the scope of the ordinance was to contest viciousness. You're suggesting the ordinance is broader and allows a person who's transferred their ownership to the city to contest that ownership in that administrative process?
Well,
is that correct?
I think,
and if so, which ordinance provision outlines the scope of such a contest?
The contest is focused on the viciousness declaration.
I didn't read in the ordinance that an owner who's given up ownership can come to that process and contest the ownership that they just gave you.
Well, I think that is an interpretation that a district court could reach, right? Somebody could make that argument before the administrative body, and the administrative body could say, that's not in the ordinance. We don't have the ability to determine who the owner is. And then that party could appeal that decision to the district court. But the process...
But the point is that neither Ms. Keller nor the project had the ability, under the express language of the owner, of the ordinance, to contest ownership, did they?
Our contention is that we are the owner of that dog.
Could you answer my question? Under the express language of the ordinance, neither Mrs. Keller nor the project had the ability to contest ownership through the administrative process.
That's a decision that an administrative body, our administrative body, probably would have reached. I think that's probably a decision that the district court would reach. But it still doesn't absolve them of the requirement to go before the administrative body, especially when they are going to challenge the viciousness declaration through the advisory committee. Those are determinations that could be made by the committee or by a district court on appeal. But you can't make an end run around those processes and get right into court and get right to the viciousness issue. Otherwise, there's no purpose for us to have these administrative proceedings.
Counsel, can I ask you one other question, kind of following up on the viciousness issue? Mr. Rosenthal said that factually, the way he, that the infant wandered in to see the dog, tripped on the dog's head, and then grabbed the dog's ear trying to get up. Do you disagree with that factual representation?
I don't think we have any evidence on the record to support that.
Okay. Was there any, did the city do any type of investigation or check anything to see if this dog had any vicious incidents with any other human being, infants, children, adults, or anything? Or, because Mr. Rosenthal indicated this was unique, this is only happened for the first time.
We've got an affidavit on file that the animal control officer had a conversation with Ms. Keller acting, who instructed him that the animal had displayed vicious tendencies toward other animals. And of course, we have the incident right before us where the baby is killed.
Right. But as far as any other interaction with humans, there was no other evidence of...
Nothing on the record reflecting that.
Okay.
Another quick point I think that's important, they've cited to NRS 163.0075 and attempted to use some language in there to justify their actions in this case. 163.005, not only did they not form the trust under that statute, but even if they did, absolutely not applicable. Read the plain language of Section 1. A trust created for the care of one or more animals that are alive at the time of the settler's death is valid. If the settler's not dead, NRS 163.0075 is not applicable. So their attempts to rely on that statute in order to justify the actions are inappropriate. And then I wanted to move to the three questions that the court asked us to specifically address. And I want to focus on the standing. Because what has fundamentally happened here is a misunderstanding of the role of a trustee with regard to the beneficiary. So the court asks us, can a trustee litigate on a beneficiary's behalf? Well, the broad answer to that question is yes. But the important question that will help the court resolve this issue is, when can a trustee litigate on behalf of a beneficiary? That comes from two concepts, standing, where we look to see whether the party has a cognizable, concrete, in the words of this court, a serious injury that can be redressed by the court. And we look to Hornbook trust law. What happens when a trust is created? You all know this, so forgive me for repeating what you already know, but when a trust is formed, when a party identifies some property, they put it into a trust. They designate a trustee and a beneficiary. The trustee takes legal title to the property that is in the trust, that is designated as the trust property. They then owe fiduciary duties to the beneficiary regarding the trust property. That's the extent of their fiduciary responsibility. So their standing comes when somebody attacks the trust property. They don't have the ability, as they claim in their briefs in the lower court, to always litigate on behalf of a beneficiary. And the parties cannot create standing where it otherwise doesn't exist. You can't create standing through a trust document. And I don't know if the court has an opportunity to review the Mitash v. Rubisky decision that we cited on our supplement, but it is a roadmap for this court. It is nearly an identical set of facts. All of these issues are addressed in that decision. The distinction, importantly here, of the difference between a trustee and other fiduciary relationships, more applicable here, what they're arguing is they should be the guardian of the dog. It's a guardian that might stand in the shoes of a beneficiary and argue on its behalf. But a guardian is appointed by a court, not appointed by a trust document. Second point you asked.
Would the analysis in that case be different had Ms. Keller reportedly transferred ownership of Onion to the trust before this suit was filed?
I think that it would be, and that is fundamental. All right, before the suit was filed, and that's the key point, right?
Right.
An owner of the animal is the one who suffers injury.
So then what is the effect of the analysis when it's raised on reconsideration before the judge enters her order?
Well, It has several effects. There is no contention at the time that this matter was heard that the owner has standing. I'm sorry, that the Lexus Project was claiming an ownership interest. So the Levitsky case would absolutely apply, and they wouldn't have standing. Now,
why isn't it in the nature of a supplemental pleading? At the time the suit was filed, it was filed on the standing issue that you contest. But then, after the suit was filed, there was a change in circumstance, which is the transfer of ownership from Ms. Keller to the Lexus Group. And under Rule 15 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, if something happens post-filing, you're entitled to bring that to the court and say, I may not have had standing when I filed this, but now I do.
You could do that.
Could you comment on that?
Yeah, you could do that through Rule 15. They didn't do that. They filed a motion for reconsideration that they have never styled as a motion to amend until they filed their pleadings with this court. I don't know how the district court judge was supposed to interpret their motion for reconsideration as a motion to amend anything, and it's still not clear to me what it is they are attempting to amend through that motion for reconsideration. You could do that. But in this case, the judge, after making the correct findings on standing and their failure to exhaust the administrative remedies, went through and analyzed their new claims of ownership. And I think that really goes to the third issue that this court asked us to address. Is Ms. Keller an interested party? No. They're before the court making ownership claims. She's not before the court making ownership claims. They're saying we have ownership. Ms. Keller's not there making saying she has ownership. She has never sought to intervene in this action. She never filed and asked to be joined as a party. And up until the time she executed that affidavit, she wanted nothing to do with this case, and I imagine she's not going to seek to join it no matter what this court
says. But after the motion for reconsideration is filed, the district court judge is faced with two parties who are making competing ownership claims to the dog. That's you and them.
That's okay. I think that can be settled by the court on an evidentiary basis, but it doesn't mean you have a necessary party because Ms. Keller's not there asserting that she has any right before the court.
Well, right. I think that is probably correct from my point of view. But at the point of the motion for reconsideration, the district judge is faced with parties who are making competing claims to the ownership of the dog. So shouldn't the district court judge resolve those claims?
She did, in that order. Look at it. It's a very detailed order. Mm-hmm. But you also have to look at what she says in the order as well. She is affirming her factual findings regarding standing and the failure to address or failure to avail themselves of the administrative proceedings that they knew were available to them.
But by your own comment a moment ago, the question of standing changed dramatically, even under the supplemental authority you provided to us, when, if found to be true, the Lexus Project owns the dog.
She addresses that in the order, because for them to be able to make that claim, they have to, for the standing to change, they have to have a valid claim of ownership, and the judge decided it. She decided it correctly on the evidence that was in front of her. Ms. Keller's affidavit and all of the evidence that we had submitted into the record, that was a determination she could make on their new claim that they had ownership, that it wasn't a valid claim.
So,
and they're still deprived of standing.
I'm a little bit confused then. Are you saying that in the final findings that she issued, the judge issued, she took into consideration Ms. Keller's affidavit indicating her transfer of ownership to the project?
If you read the judge's order, the May 31st order, it's cautiously and carefully constructed. She affirms her findings on original findings on standing. She discusses the fact that she doesn't have to consider these issues on reconsideration, and then she analyzes what would happen if she did consider those issues on reconsideration. I don't know if this was the 20-minute clock or the 15-minute.
It was the 20-minute clock.
I have a quick moment to conclude.
Surely, please.
If you accept these arguments, you can take the names off these pleadings. You can take the name off Onion off these pleadings, and you can insert the name of any pet owner in Nevada, and under their arguments, any pet owner around the country, and they would have the ability to come into court and drag a pet owner into court whenever they deemed that they were arguing on behalf of that animal. That is a fundamental alteration of the doctrines of standing, property law, and trust law in this court.
Not if the pet owner hadn't transferred ownership of their pet. It's a key fact in this case.
I acknowledge that, Your Honor. It is a key fact. Ownership is key to the issue of standing here, but it was decided correctly by the district court that they did not have ownership, and you should affirm those orders. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.